Do you want?
There you
Great.
Go. Okay.
I start my recorder too. So.
Okay.
Do you want? Do you want to speak?
Privately? Before? No, I'll say anything to the world. Just about.
Yeah. Okay. So I can start, and we can just start discussing. And I don't know.
Yeah. So you started a podcast, or tell me what was behind that. What are you interested in doing?
Why I started this podcast, it's a hard question in a sense, because there are multiple reasons, but I think now that I have started to go to university to study theology, I feel more secure to do this kind of stuff. That's one reason, and or maybe that's just a reason why I don't shy away from it. But the shortest answer is I want people to know about Orthodox faith and tradition and so on. But my second reason is I want to speak with people. So it doesn't need to be, you know, a theological discussion all the time. I'm interested in speaking with people. And so I'm trying to balance those two goals in the same podcast, if that's possible. So why did you start your podcast? Maybe I should give you an introduction before, or a short one.
Okay.
So people probably know who you are and not who I am. But anyways, I have with me today Paul van der Klee, if I'm pronouncing your name right. Mm-hmm. And he's a pastor of Living Stones Christian Reformed Church in Sacramento, California. And he has also a YouTube channel called Paul van der Klee that you can visit. And I will leave a link below so you can find it more easily. But I found Paul by, you did some once or I think twice or maybe more times interviews or speeches with, you talked with Jordan Peterson and Jonathan Page also. And that's basically how I found your channel. And yes, but maybe you can say something more about yourself and why you started your YouTube channel. I know you have put a very good introduction on your YouTube page that people can watch if they want a lengthier reason to that.
I started with YouTube early when I would just post sermons there in case someone at church missed one. So that was sort of a utility. And then a member of my church wanted to do a show. He had been involved with a radio show before and that had stopped. And so he wanted to do something. And so I made little shows with him on YouTube. And then Jordan Peterson came around and I was very interested in his work. And I thought probably I tried talking about it with some colleagues of mine and friends, and not a lot of people were very interested. And so I thought, well, why don't I make a video on YouTube and see what happens? And that sort of launched my channel for a lot of people and began a lot of conversations around Jordan Peterson, and then people, because I was a Christian minister, Jonathan Peugeot was known to be Jordan's friend and had done a couple of videos with him. So people were saying, well, you should talk to Jonathan Peugeot. So I started talking to Jonathan Peugeot, and then just people started contacting me, and this whole thing just kept going. And so I originally started doing this because I had a lot of things I wanted to think about and talk to people about. And I eventually discovered that YouTube wasn't a bad way to do that. So some of my videos are, I do rough drafts of my Sunday sermons on my channel. A lot of my videos are thinking out loud. I do commentary on other content, podcasts or YouTube videos that I find to be interesting. And then I do conversations with people, and it's begun a good thing. And one of the other interests I have is that churches, I don't think, have done a very good job of creating spaces for meaningful conversations with people that allow people to sort of process their questions and their thoughts about God and about church. And so then I also worked with some people and started what I call estuary projects, where there are places for people to talk. So that's, I've been doing this for a little over 3 years now on YouTube, and it's been fun. And so I'll probably do it until either I don't have time for it anymore or it seems counterproductive. But for now, it's been a cool thing.
So what do people want to talk about?
Well, I'm a pastor, and so I'm used to talking to people about a lot of things. People usually want to talk about what hurts them, what they're angry about, what they're sad about. Sometimes they just need to share their story with someone, to have another human being listen seriously to them, and so that they have a sense of importance and meaning and place in this world. And so I can't talk to everybody who wants to talk to me in internet land. It's a little bit easier in my church is quite small. It's a little bit easier in real life. Not that many people in real life necessarily want to talk to me, but on the internet, it's a big place. And so then I have what I call rando slots, where people can just sign up and get a slot and off we go. And then sometimes I'll post those on my channel, and that then sort of feeds the community with a culture of listening and meeting and talking. And so that's kind of how we've been using YouTube.
Yeah. So in your experience, then, do you think are people having the same kind of problems today as they did, let's say, 15 years ago? Or has something changed?
Some of our problems are perennial. They're simply a function of the human condition. But context-wise, those things are always changing. You know, the life of a church in a subculture changes. You know, the issues that were relevant to people 15 years ago, maybe not so much, and new issues have arisen. So in that way, local ministry is always a living thing, that there's always new things coming at us, but yet there's repetition, there's perennial issues. And so you can sort of gain wisdom, but there's also enough freshness that you can, you know, it continues to be interesting.
Yeah, I have heard people say, I don't know if this is reflected in statistics, but that today we are very much torn apart politically, and that's affects also the relationships we have with each other, with our friends, and maybe even within a family. Have you seen some of that in your experience?
Oh yeah. There are always conflicts among us, but I'm noticing, especially in my denomination, that there's polarization in the American political scene. People are less tolerant and patient with each other, and less willing to overlook political and religious differences than they used to be. And that's a deeply troubling sign, because if they're less able to do that, then their capacity to understand each other goes down, and then the propensity for deeper separation and maybe even violence goes up. And that would be a very sad thing to see happen.
Yes. So one question I have is, if we are taking a broader view now and looking at the world, before you give your, if you have any solutions, what do you think is, where are we going, basically? Are we going to a better place or to a worse place? Is everything falling apart? What's your take there?
It's hard to know, really. I hear a lot of pessimism around me. I'm old enough now to have remember the 1960s and 70s to a degree, especially the 70s. In the 1970s in the United States, during the Vietnam War, there were regularly bombings. There were violent extremist groups that were doing acts of terror in the United States. We don't see anywhere near as much of that. And so it's often difficult to judge and compare between different ages, partly because people express their discontent in different ways. Also, we live now in an internet era, and we have no idea how the internet, social media, we clearly know that this is a part of our sense of dis-ease, but these tools were not available in the 1970s. And so maybe instead of the Weather Underground blowing up buildings, we're just blowing up people's reputations. Now, is that better or worse? There's at least no bloodshed, or, less bloodshed. So it's very, very difficult to know, because there are elements of our context today that are new. And so all we can do is sort of guess from the past. So maybe things won't come to blows. And I hope for that. But it's new because of the internet, so we don't know.
Do you think the internet is the decisive new thing that have changed, let's say, our way of life with previous generations?
Well, it's certainly a big one.
Yeah.
But how it will impact, I don't think any of us can know, partly because the internet itself is changing rapidly. In the early mid 1990s, the internet was sort of a new wonky thing. And then before 2007, you had laptops and computers. After 2007, you began to see the rise of the smartphone. And the smartphone has changed the internet. Are we going to, and the smartphone is sort of, a fairly primitive step towards cyborgism, let's say. So we've got this thing in our hand and we can put it in our pocket. What happens if guys like Elon Musk are successful with their conceptualizations about a Neuralink, when we can sort of browse the web without a handheld device, unmediated through eyes and fingers and voice? We have no idea what that would mean. Yeah. So it's really hard to know what's coming down the pike. And, so we have a lot of talk about AI, artificial intelligence. That is already impacting us. And I can see it in how social media feeds, my YouTube feed, because I spend a fair amount of time on YouTube now because I put stuff on YouTube. I can already see how that impacts me. I can see how the algorithms behind Twitter impact me. I'm mostly off of Facebook, so that's not impacting me like it was before. But again, this is all new. But old things are still there too. So it's a piling on. There's an accumulation of these factors. And the speed at which this is coming at us is remarkable. The Protestant Reformation was a big deal, partly because of the printing press.
Yep.
And 1492, Columbus, you know, discovers the Americas. You have, as some people would say, the Columbian Exchange, you know, the first critical step towards a globalization. World trade networks begin. I mean, there are just so many aspects. And so that's a factor in the Protestant Reformation as well. Galileo, I mean, that speed is just increasing.
Yeah. So basically we have the same human being, but he's becoming more powerful. So what then, if you can connect what you have said now to, let's say, a virtuous life, what happens if a society is becoming less virtuous but more powerful?
Well, when we say we have the same human being, that's sort of true. Biologically, we don't change that rapidly. But then again, what do we mean by we? Virtue. You know, if you read in the book of Proverbs, you read in Hebrew wisdom literature, you know, virtue, what is virtue? Of course, the Greeks talked about virtue, but the virtue of the Greeks and the virtue of the Hebrews were a little bit different. And obviously, as Christians, we believe that there's definitely a revelatory aspect of virtue. We learn virtue from the scriptures. We learn virtue from saints that have gone before us. But the figuring out the connection between virtue and wisdom is not easy. I think, for example, I'm working on the book of Thessalonians for my sermon this morning. And, you know, pondering the Jews in the Jewish diaspora in the time of Paul of Tarsus. And so Paul goes to these synagogues that are spread, and, you know, in Acts 17, we have the story of Paul going into the synagogue at Thessalonica. And if you read the book of Acts, you realize that in almost every case, Paul goes into these synagogues and starts talking about Jesus and the resurrection. And within a few weeks or months, there's going to be a division between those who become increasingly interested in what Paul has to say about Jesus and the resurrection, and those who see this as a dangerous disruption of the life that they are trying to create in a very dynamic, dangerous, hostile environment. I mean, the Jews sort of always walked a line in the Roman Empire. They didn't participate in the cult of Caesar. And so they, you know, they were always on shifting ground. And then Paul and this word about Jesus and the resurrection, this is all very dangerous for them. So there's this. Okay, so what does virtue look like in a context like that? They had to, in some ways, work that out. And Paul's emphasis is quite clearly on, you know, as he says in 2 Corinthians 5, this ministry of reconciliation. Well, there was a lot of non-reconciliation going on between Jews who were accepting Jesus as Messiah and the resurrection, and Jews who weren't. And then even within the church, Jews like Paul who were saying Gentiles need not be circumcised, and Jews who embrace the resurrection and Jesus as Messiah is saying, no, Gentiles ought to be circumcised to come into the story of God and Israel. So how then are these virtues manifest? There are times, for example, in the book of Galatians, where Paul is very direct and very harsh with his adversaries. Is that virtuous? Well, these questions take on a lot of wisdom. And so now as we, ply the waters of 2,000 years of Christian history and tradition, trying to figure out, what does Christ call us? What does virtue look like in an internet age and a social media age? If we are going to participate on these platforms effectively, how does virtue and, wisdom, and especially in the Old Testament, is, excellence. How do virtue and excellence meet as avatars on Twitter and talking images on Facebook and YouTube? So we're going to have to leverage that ancient wisdom because we're trying to figure this out.
Yeah, I think that when I'm thinking now what you have said, I'm thinking that to be virtuous doesn't mean that you're nice all the time.
Right.
So that's why sometimes even God needs to say some harsh things, because the truth can be exactly it can be exactly what we need. But for me, when I ask this question, I meant more, people have said, if we are going to have a free society, if we are speaking just on that level, people, if people want to steal all the time, we will have to have more police, and slowly but steadily we will become a more authoritarian, type of society. So that's why I see a connection between people having this virtuous life, let's say, not stealing, speaking truth, at least not lying, let's say, and those kind of things. But you're right. I mean, it's not, at least in the Orthodox perspective, it's not simply about a moralism. It's something more. If you read Orthodox literature about virtue, they speak about its participating in God, because Christ said only God is good. So if you're doing the good, you're participating in God's life. So it's much more than this, I'm doing a good thing. Maybe on a societal level, it can help. But even then, if we are not connected with the source of life, of goodness, of beauty, maybe even that, on that level, it will not last. So, but in either case, what do you think we need to do then? So we have the internet, we have all kinds of different things facing us. I mean, we have the atomic bomb. We're not speaking about that so much right now, but it's just a small factor lying there, for some crazy person to activate. So, and if I just give one a small answer, at least maybe that this is not an answer, but I think in either case, at least we as Christians, we should not be afraid. We should at least have this confidence, I think, because it's sometimes the devil, let's say, can look very intimidating. He can look very controlling, having all the power, but there is something with the light. You can have a lot of darkness, but just a little light, it's still stronger. It will still shine. So we have this confidence that when Christ comes, let's say, or even today when we see him in our everyday life, he has conquered death, he has conquered darkness. So there is not, we're not discussing this dualistic world. Well, what are we going to do about this darkness? But at the same time, I think we are in the danger of, like my spiritual father said to me, the biggest enemy is yourself. So yes, I believe that Christ have conquered death and evil and sin and the devil, but I haven't. So if I'm not joining, let's say, Christ, or maybe I can actually, in the sense, get lost and fall into a pit of darkness. And we have seen that many times, people doing that. So how are we going? Now I'm speaking to you as another Christian. How are we going to, at the same time, realize that there is a real danger out there, but at the same time, not being afraid? And I don't know, how do you balance all that out?
I look at the beginning of the book of Acts for a lot of guidance in that. The book begins with Jesus and the apostles, and they are gathered, and the apostles ask Jesus, so when are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel? Which is a very interesting question. And Jesus sort of sidesteps it because he doesn't want to derail the conversation. He says, it's not for you to know the times or the dates, but you will receive power when my Holy Spirit comes upon you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and to the ends of the earth. And I think that, for me, is sort of our marching orders to be his witnesses, to receive the power that he gives us by his Spirit. And then if as you watch that begin to unfold and play out in the book of Acts, one of the things that very early on people begin to notice about Jesus' followers is boldness. And boldness is a manifestation of a deep security that God is in heaven, and that this is my Father's world, and that he gives us his Spirit. And now all of this has to be taken with the kind of seriousness that we find Jesus talking about in the Gospels, saying things like, they'll hate you like they hated me. In this world, you will have trouble. But do not be afraid, I have overcome the world. So this, I think, should give us a loving boldness. Often boldness is filled with self. In this case, the boldness comes from God. And it's not a boldness that rejoices in egoist owning our rivals, but is a boldness that celebrates lovingly coming around and doing the reconciliation that Jesus' work initiates. So for me, that's where this begins. And in terms of, what has happened around me on YouTube, I want to bear witness. I want to manifest that spirit in a degree of boldness, but also in the command of love. And just as you said, love is not simply, love is definitely not niceness. Kindness is a fruit of the Spirit, but love has the boldness and courage to, let's speak the truth in love, as Paul says. So that, I think, is the way Christians approach this world. Also, standing on the resurrection, because for those now in a modern age that are influenced by materialism, that believe that this is all they have or get or will be, the resurrection informs Christians that this is the first stage of our journey, and that we can, like Jesus followers, be bold and in some ways liberal with our time and with our lives in witness to Christ. Because just as he did, Jesus did not maximize his biological lifetime. He understood exactly what his mission was, and he lived it, and he accomplished it, and he is now doing that through us, through his Spirit. So for me, I see it very much at the heart of the Christian story in terms of the Spirit's coming, the resurrection of Christ, as bearing witness to the kingdom of God wherever we are at.
Okay, thank you for your thoughts. And so what you have spent, you have made many videos commenting on the Jordan Peterson phenomena, yeah, as you mentioned in your introduction. And having done so, what do you think he has played? What do you think his role have been, at least for now, in this world, in this discussion? Because many people have, in a strange way, maybe that's not strange at all, they have found Christ through him, and even gone beyond his own, let's say, journey, and embrace it full-heartedly. So why do you think that have happened now, or do you see any meaning in that?
Oh, yeah. I think, and I got this from a listener to my channel. I mean, my channel has always been about me learning. That sounds rather selfish, but I try to share my learning with all of you to not be so selfish. And a doctor in Idaho made the comment to me about the end of modernity, the end of the modern age. And I think Jordan Peterson is the rise of the new atheists is a tell of the end of the modern age, because they, at a deep level, feel modernity slipping away.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are trying to keep it and grab it. And in fact, the whole intellectual dark web is sort of right in that space. And Jordan is too. Jordan is in many ways part of that group. I think he's an exceptional part of that group. But Jordan is right on this. Jonathan Peugeot, in his conversation with Jordan, talked about it, I think, very well, in terms of the dividing of this continent. And Jordan is in some ways a deep modernist who is very determined to not let the fruits of modernity go without a fight. But in this process, he has been, I think manifesting the end of modernity. And what that has meant is, Jonathan Peugeot just put out a video on transcendence and immanence, which I thought was... Yep, I thought it was a good video. And in many ways, a lot of those issues are the issues behind Jordan's rise. Because part of what he was able to do, I talk about this in terms of what I call God number one and God number two. And I don't, that's not a Trinitarian mapping at all. And people almost always say, well, what about number three? No, there is no number three, because it's much more immanence and transcendence. So there's only one and two. And what, when I listened to Jordan talk to Sam Harris, what I could hear was, in modernity, as modernity sort of reached its climax, God became almost exclusively transcendent. And what Jordan was able to do with modernist language was reveal God's immanence, that God number oneness. And that, I think, at a deep level, broke part of the grip of modernity from the hearts of a lot of people. And that then made the gospel, the Christian gospel, attractive and intelligible for a lot of people. Jonathan Peugeot himself noted that he didn't believe earlier his channel would have been understood. And I think he's right about that. And mm-hmm. and what's yeah. happening is that the world is changing. We aren't terribly aware of it, but in our intuitive processing, we're feeling it and we're seeing the signs. And so Jordan was right at that cusp. And so he's vitally important for that. And the Jordan Peterson phenomenon, I think, is intelligible by viewing the end of modernity and the beginning of we know not what. You know, post-modernity has been around for a little while, but it seems increasingly clear that isn't going to be fruitful in the way we want it to be. So, and I think for that reason, the Orthodox Church, which is a very ancient.
What's that?
Yeah. In America, it's very easy to say, what's that? But yeah. That's, I think it's for that reason that the sacramentalist tradition of the Orthodox, the Roman Catholics, to a degree, the Anglicans, is really, for a lot of people, sort of coming online for them in America in a rather dramatic way. I was watching this, so in the late 90s, aughts, I was very involved in church planting in my Protestant denomination. And the churches we began planting were sort of seeker churches. They're in many ways very Protestant, very evangelical. Most of those churches have, over the last 10 years, become increasingly neo-sacramental, where liturgy is a little bit more formalized. There's more emphasis, weekly communion, Eucharist. You keep the presence of water in the sanctuary, more symbolism, more ritual. And I've been watching this happen in churches. And when I would talk to people who were doing it, trying to figure out, do you know why you're doing this? Well, they have no idea. They just know that these are the right next steps. And so, of course, for the Orthodox to come around, it's like, well, here are a people who have been doing this and practicing this. And, you know, they've had a lot of their act together on many of these scores for a very long time. And so suddenly everybody's looking at them and sort of beginning to, you know, haphazardly appropriate little bits and pieces of it. So to have someone like Jonathan Peugeot say, I'm not going to just pick away at this. I'm going to jump into the middle of it and immerse myself in it. And many others doing so, to me, makes perfect sense.
Yeah. Yeah, that was great. I was thinking about that when I watched Jonathan Peugeot's video that you mentioned, that the Orthodox have a language for this God being, in one sense, away. We speak about his essence and then the energies of God. That took a long time even for me to understand. I mean, energy, what's that? That's physics? What do you mean by energy? So, but people can look that up. We don't need to go into that now. But basically that, and many fathers speak like that. If you read St. John of Damascus, he starts by God is, he really makes the case that we can't know anything about God, but then says, but we have the incarnation and, you know, God is present through his energy. Maybe I can ask you, what effect have Jonathan Peugeot, if any, had on your view about the Orthodox Church or on Christianity in general?
Jonathan has been deeply influential in my in my very much in my view of the Orthodox Church. So what's amazing is that there's a lot of stuff that's packed into us that we don't recognize. And so iconoclasm, of course, I am a minister in the Christian Reformed Church, which is a separatist movement off the Dutch state church. And it's a fairly young tradition. I don't know how long it will last, but it's one of these Protestant churches that sort of flourishes and disappears like Jonah's vine, especially as compared to the Orthodox. So, you know, what Jonathan was able to do for me was help me understand a lot better, or so many things, and maybe in ways that I can't even properly articulate yet. But, you know, so initially, you know, even before Jordan Peterson and Jonathan Peugeot, I began watching colleagues of mine have icons in their offices and studies. And when it comes to Christian Reformed ministers, we're a fairly bookish bunch, but I'm probably on the high end of bookishness. And I've always enjoyed church history and history in general. And so when I'd see colleagues have Orthodox icons in their offices, I thought, and part of me knew they're just doing this. There's an iconoclasm that was built into our denominational DNA was being lost slowly. And so then when I first started talking to Jonathan and we had a conversation online and we've had a few online, we've never met in person, but, you know, I immediately liked Jonathan. We had some commonalities in that we had both done overseas mission work, and, you know, John is a very likable guy and we hit it off. So, I could very much sense him as a brother in Christ, and he's an icon carver. So maybe it was sort of a, you know, Peter in Caesarea and the house of Cornelius moment. It's like, all right, well, you know, I'm not going to smash his icons and I'm not going to call him a heretic. And he's taught me a ton about symbolism, and he's given me a lot of language and conceptualization to, I think in some ways, revivify some of the older code in Calvinism that Calvin was sort of, you know, bringing in from church fathers. And of course, Calvin's relationship with church fathers, there's a degree of ambiguity there, like there is in all of these Protestant reformers. But yeah. So Jonathan has been a gateway drug for a lot of things that are rather surprising for a Dutch Calvinist.
Yeah, maybe you can. That's a question that I have had for a time now. That's what is the traditional Protestant use of or of the church fathers? I know they use them very much because, you know, they actually come from the Catholic tradition. I know that's a shock for people to hear, but but what's the relationship with them? What place do they have to Calvin, let's say?
Well, it varies in terms of pastors now. It varies tremendously. I began to notice, again, colleagues of mine who were going to, you know, weekly Eucharist, started calling it Eucharist instead of Lord's Supper, which Lord's Supper was sort of the traditional language in my denomination. Now they're calling it Eucharist. And now they're much more disciplined about the lectionary. And so they're observing liturgical seasons and they're suddenly reading church fathers. And church fathers, for many Protestant denominations, all the way, you know, into the 60s and 70s. So this is a little book written in the mid 60s from my denomination. The only church father you're probably going to find in here is Augustine. Okay. So Augustine is the guy for Luther, for Calvin. They're going to turn away from Aquinas. They're not going to talk about, you know, you do too much poking around in Irenaeus and, you know, especially Greek fathers, you might find yourself in a little bit of trouble. So if you stick to Augustine, you'll probably be safe. And so there was very, very little. And there was some treatment of church fathers in my seminary training, but almost no direct original source reading. And so then the people we did read would tend to be reformational, you know, reformers, Luther, Calvin, and then we jump to much more modern individuals, like at least in the Dutch Reformed, Kuyper and Bavinck. So
yeah.
So very little church fathers.
You know, we Orthodox sometimes we think we know the fathers, but we don't. And I had a fun exchange just yesterday. I wrote a text and I quoted Socrates, and then a Greek guy, I don't know him, but he said, "Shame on you that speak about, you know, this pagans," something like that. And I just referred to him St. Basil's treatise on to the young, how people that, yes, we can read those texts, you know, we can leave the bad stuff out. We don't need all the vulgar Greek fantasies. We can leave that, but we can, you know, accept the other stuff about virtue and so on. And he said to me, "Oh, Basil here and Basil there. I don't care." It's like, what do you want me to do? So it's apparently he has not read the fathers, but he thinks they must have had a view he holds. But no, actually, okay, maybe some people said, you know, the Greeks, you know, what relationship is between Athens and Jerusalem? There are these, and it's some truth to that too, you know. But most fathers did, they were very intelligent, and they knew the contemporary writers, and they used them to bring people to Christ. It's not like they thought about Saint Socrates or Saint Aristotle, but they used them. And they found the common ground, and then said, "So let us receive the you know, not only the Son, but the Son of Righteousness." So they always. But anyway, yeah, you're right. So I say this because you know, at least Protestants, if they don't use the fathers, at least they have, you know, it's a conviction that leads them to that. But we Orthodox, if we say we want to use the fathers, it's a shame that we don't, but we say we do. But that's just a note.
Well, I think part of the weakness. So in my training, so then the creeds, I mean, the Nicene Creed, the Athanasian Creed, these are sort of little. Okay, so these documents are just sort of floating out there in midair. In Protestant, for at least for the Protestants that actually embrace the creeds. And I think all of those were sort of just the tips of rocks. And then at some point, Protestants are going to say, well, that didn't just come out of nowhere. There's a broad, vivid conversation behind these things that have emerged. And maybe we should be a little curious about them. And maybe they'd have something to tell us. And actually, I think, again, part of how the Orthodox Church in America is impacting the American church scene is exactly that, that some Protestants are recognizing we have some blind sides in our picture of the church. And there are some old biases and prejudices that we probably are going to have to let go of and more honestly take a look at all of this history that is our history as well, that perhaps only just the tips, such as these creedal documents, are have been exposed to us. We need to see more.
Yeah. So let us change gears now, or I have written words, so I have not formulated a question around them. I wanted to try this type of interview with you, so you're the first person to, don't know how this will go, but I will give you a word and you can say whatever you want about it. What's like the first thing you think about it? So I say, let's say, what should I take? Okay. Friendship.
I immediately think of Greek. I think of phileo. Okay. Friendship is such a... I think of the Lord of the Rings. And I think about Sam and Frodo. And then Aragorn and Gandalf and the Fellowship of the Ring. Because, you know, the older I get, the more I value friendship. It's a sweet, sweet gift of God.
Yeah. It's sorry.
No, continue. It's powerful.
Yeah. I feel that we don't talk about it so much. We are aware that we need to speak about marriage and the problems and the difficulties that people experience within a marriage, but we don't speak about the friendship and what that means. And I had this light go up in me because, you know, we read the gospel and Christ said no one has more love than, it's like, what is going to say, you know, the person that gave his life for his friends. And I'm like, why his friends, not his enemies? Or what do you mean there? So, and that's a verse I don't fully understand because we're not trained in speaking about friendship. And now I don't know if friendship in the ancient times is exactly the same thing as we think about it today. There are some difference maybe, but anyway.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
Look at Gilgamesh and Enkidu. I mean, all the way back to the Gilgamesh epic. And it's I always see that in contrast to Adam and Eve in, you know, Genesis 2 and 3. And so I think, you know, but friendship is a big, big thing.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take the next question or word. Individualism.
I think there's an inevitability about individualism, but on the whole, it leaves sort of a bad taste in my mouth. Because I think it has led to a loss of friendship. That especially American culture, we so value individual autonomy, which is a good, that we miss some of the deeper goods like friendship and community. And friendship and community and marriage always come to one degree or another at the sacrifice of individual autonomy. So individualism, not a happy thing.
Yeah. Do you think we sometimes, the only language we can speak is the political language? So maybe in the political arena, people can have the opinion that individualism is something that's that can be good, that the state is not viewing everyone in categories. But on a religious level, maybe it can be more damaging to the sense that we are a church.
Yeah.
communion.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, well, I love C.S. Lewis wrote a wonderful essay on membership. Mm-hmm. And as members of Christ's body, we are individuals. There's no piece of my body, even let's say, you know, my two pointer fingers, they are each individual. They are not perfectly identical. They're very similar, but they're not perfectly identical. And so they are in some ways individual, but they are members of my body. And so it's only in the context of membership that, in a sense, that the individual glories are able to be celebrated. So I think that's true.
Okay. The next question or word is, or two words, American Christianity.
Boy. Oh, boy.
Let's stop the interview now.
You know, on one hand, see, so when I think of American Christianity, and this is so cliche, I think of sort of megachurch Protestantism. And I don't know, and I shouldn't think that way necessarily, because there are many American Catholics. Yeah. But when I think of American Catholics, you know, it's part of the difficulty is that Americans are so notoriously ahistorical. It is such a new country. And then the churches bear that. It's such a pragmatic culture. And the churches manifest that. So some of those, yet at the same time, you know, American Christianity is most of my life experience. You know, Christianity in the Dominican Republic, a lot of American Christianity and Dominican Christianity. But at the same time, I've known just wonderful Christians who are deeply American Christians. They're sacrificial, they're loving, they're faithful, they're enduring, they're long-suffering. Yeah. So, yeah, and I'm sure there are issues with every other kind of Christianity on the planet. So,
yeah,
you make your peace with it.
Yeah. There are a lot of problems everywhere.
Yeah.
How much time do you have? Or
just pop in. So we can go another 15 minutes and then I should really see what he needs.
Great. Okay. So I have a question now that's a bit more serious. And I think Jordan Peterson's answer to this question or answers to these questions are very good on many levels, but I want you to hear your take on it. And what went wrong in the 20th century, you know? Why did we as a society, as human beings, and why did we end up killing each other in the way we did, in the numbers that we did, and the brutality that colored these acts?
I think it was because we could. I don't know that the 20th century was more brutal than any of the centuries before in terms of human intention. It's just that we now had the technology to do it. And, you know, genocide was not an invention of the 20th century. Genocide has been practiced by human beings, you know, for a very, very long time. And in the 20th century, probably, you know, in some ways, perhaps our horror at the 20th century is itself a manifestation of the continued ways that Christ has impacted our moral imagination. Because in many centuries, we have attempted and succeeded at genocide against people groups and thought nothing of it. And so now in the 20th century, we grew a conscience. So, you know, our experience of horror at the 20th century is potentially also an exhibit of the continued supremacy and power of Christ and his spirit to shape our moral imaginations.
Do you think that, you know, we have the loss of faith, you know, what Nietzsche spoke about, that it had played a role in this happening?
Oh, definitely. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things that came out of my most recent conversation with John Vervaeke and J.P. Marceau was John Vervaeke, who is a non-theist, expressing, you know, his horror at utopian ambitions. And I think this is a real part of the problem that, and I see this both in Christians and in atheists, that if suddenly we sort of embrace an atheistic imaginary and the secular sphere, this little short lifespan that we have, are the limits of the canvas within which we either can do whatever we can do. It's like, okay, put your life on this 3x5 card. Things are going to get bloody indeed, because, you know, Stalin, I mean, why did Stalin, I just recently saw on Twitter, someone posted, you know, pictures from this, you know, Stalin starved the Ukraine and Belarus because he took all of the grain and brought it to the cities. And he starved the farmers. And he did it because, well, that's just what the eschatology of our ideology requires. So sacrifices have to be made. And this is what we see when there is no longer a heaven in which God can, you know, accomplish the perfecting of us, which we need and he seems to desire. And there is not a hell in which the injustices that are done in this world are accounted for. So you take off both those areas. And like I've said many times, when you try to bring down heaven, you usually bring up hell. And it's because you're trying to fit it all on this little 3x5 card. And that is clearly part of what happened in the 20th century, especially with communism, that, okay, well, let's get busy working towards the eschaton. And they starved the Ukraine and Belarus, that they were the sacrifice needed for Stalin to pursue his dream. And we've seen this again and again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's such a horrible, you know, period. And as you said, it's not new. If you read history, people have done these kind of things all the time, but it's the scale in some sense that's new. How do you think, the last question here, if we are going to avoid this, I don't think we can, to be honest. If what I have seen of humans, I don't think we can. As soon as we have gone away from this, I don't want this to be true. I hope I'm wrong. But we will, you know, we have the habit of doing the same kind of mistakes and horrible things to each other all the time. So, but knowing that, that maybe can also be the key to actually doing something. So what's your view here? What should people do?
We have not avoided it many times, but we have other times. You know, I was reading this morning an article. There's increasing anxiety if mainland China is going to try by force of arms to annex Thailand.
Ooh.
That's such a scary prospect, because for good reason, the United States, Japan, South Korea, Australia, you know, none of those parties want to see China deciding it wants to expand its borders. Will, you know, and I think you said it well, we are not going to escape these kinds of things. And I think the Bible is written, you know, again, I've just been reading 1 Thessalonians, and in 1 Thessalonians 1-3, wrath comes up significantly twice. And Paul is talking about the coming wrath. And what wrath are you talking about? Well, wrath comes regularly to this world, and it comes in many different forms, and it comes in wars. It comes in plagues and famine. And, you know, a lot of people thought, well, we're done with plagues. No, apparently we're not. And I'm sure we're not done with wars, and I'm sure we're not done with hunger. So, but at the same time, you know, we never had the nuclear exchange that was feared when I was growing up. So I'm a year younger than Jordan Peterson. I grew up during the Cold War, just outside of New York City. A nuclear exchange was a very real possibility. It didn't happen. Praise God. And, you know, when you go back over history and you learn about near misses, like, you know, there was a failure in the Soviet system and they thought the United States had launched in the 80s and they didn't launch. And, oh, it was an error in our computers. You know, it's like, I just look at that and say that by the providence of God, we didn't do it. That doesn't mean we won't. And I know there's a lot of conversation about climate change. And I'm not skeptical that we pump enough CO2 into the atmosphere. It won't make a difference. The world is warming slowly. Whether we can do anything about it, I don't know. You know, we are small. We just are. And so the perennial troubles that impact this world, we won't escape from. And for me, in my 50 some odd years of living, I've lived at a very wonderful time in a very wonderful place. And I should have nothing but gratitude for that. But economic collapse, environmental collapse, wars, floods in Sacramento, we're a very low-lying city. In this world, you will have trouble. So, but the Christian faith, I believe, better than any other faith, gives us hope and long-suffering, that when the troubles come, we can also know joy. So that's my faith.
We have a God that have gone through this himself.
That's right.
On the cross.
That's right.
So, all right. I think ending with hope is a good thing to do.
I think so too.
And if you have something to say, or point people to something, to your blog or to your podcast, you can do that now.
If they're curious about me, if you just Google me. I've got a YouTube channel. I sometimes do video summaries on my on a Substack because my YouTube videos are very long. I have an audio version of my YouTube videos for those for whom the software is just easier to manage with a podcast. But other than that, it's basically an invitation to think with me and to talk together to the degree that we have time and to, that's what I'm doing. So if you find it helpful, join in.
All right. Thank you for this discussion then. And thank you. Thanks to the everyone listening. And I will see you soon again. Bye.
All right. Thank you, John. Take care.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.